The intrepid souls who climbed the narrow, curved stairs to the very top of the Duomo Cathedral in Florence are eventually rewarded by heavenly views over the city. In their ascent, however, they are also reminded of their own mortality. Vasari's fresco of the Last Judgment, with its lurid depictions of winged demons enthusiastically hurling sinners into everlasting torment, is a serious rap on the knuckles for those of us who have strayed from the path of righteousness. An even starker reminder of our mortality, perhaps, is the sign at the entrance of the Duomo, warning visitors that the lung-bursting 463-step climb should not be attempted by those who suffer from any of a long list of ailments: shortness of breath, bad knees, vertigo, cardiac trouble, claustrophobia, and many more. On the day of my visit, the number of tourists who, even to my untrained eye, obviously suffered from rare combinations of some or all of these conditions, and yet were still intent on making the climb, was heartwarming to behold. Their lack of fear seemed like a fist of defiance shaken in the face of mortality. Equally uplifting in a perverse way was the amount of graffiti that visitors have scrawled on the walls and low ceilings, despite the many signs in Italian and English asking them to refrain from doing so. I suspect their graffiti is a form of self-congratulation. For what is graffiti, if not the ordinary man's protest against his own mortality? His way of shouting, "I was here," to future generations. I imagine hordes of wheezing, breathless tourists, so overjoyed to have made it past the Last Judgment without a medical emergency, that they decide to register their pleasure at being alive by scrawling their names as proof that they once were there. It's a bid for immortality. In my youth, I was virulently anti-graffiti. Scrawling anything on a wall seemed reprehensible. I can even recall tut-tutting in disapproval when I learned how those literary tearaways, Yeats, Shaw and O'Casey, carved their initials into Lady Gregory's tree in Cool Park. But the passing years, the gradual improvement in the quality of graffiti, and the way in which it has evolved into street art have all softened my stance. The path that winds its way past a bandstand in Bushy Park in Temple Ogue was my road to Damascus. A few years back, while walking the dog there, I was surprised to see that the main wall of the bandstand was covered in an elaborately painted blue heart, borne aloft by large green wings. Even more surprising was the legend painted across the heart, nothing as banal as "Richie loves Lisa," but rather the Latin words "Me Pinitet." If you struggled your way through Leaving Cert Latin, you may remember that this phrase means "I'm sorry." I was impressed. The notion that there was a crazed classicist on the loose in Bushy Park, spray-painting public walls with apologies in a language everyone thought was dead, appealed to me. Suddenly, Latin itself began to feel immortal. I had a similar sensation not long after in Paris when I stumbled across the graffiti-covered home of Serge Gainsbourg, the controversial bad boy of French music. His house in Rue de Verneuil, just across the river from the Louvre, has lain sealed up since his death in 1991, its contents undisturbed. The ashtrays still contain the butts of his beloved Gitane cigarettes, apparently. The house is an empty tomb. But the effect of the fans constantly scrawling their names or favourite lyrics on the wall, or the graffiti artists who turn up every few weeks to create new murals of Gainsbourg, is somehow to confer a kind of immortality on someone who has been dead for nearly 30 years. Banksy, probably the preeminent graffiti artist of our times, is credited with the line, "People say graffiti is ugly, irresponsible and childish, but that's only if it's done properly." I hesitate to disagree with Banksy on the subject of graffiti, but it seems to me that much of the street art we see around us is attractive, thought-provoking and amusing. Only a few days ago, A walk along the south wall to the Poolbeg Lighthouse brought me past a series of murals connected with the Late Late Toy Show that enlivens an otherwise dull expanse of concrete. On the lighthouse itself, looking out anxiously towards Howth, is a well-executed version of Blinky, the three-eyed fish from The Simpsons, now regarded as a symbol of marine pollution. Its message is clear. For many in Dublin, the mural that appeared on the gable of a building on South Richmond Street a few months after the death of Seamus Heaney sums up the potential of graffiti. Created by Mazur, it reads in large letters, "Don't be afraid." A translation from the Latin of the final text message that Heaney sent to his wife just before he passed away, it pays homage to a major literary figure and at the same time exhorts us all to fight and not to heed the wounds. It asks us to be like those tourists climbing the Duomo, to forget that we are mortal.
Luke Kelly died almost unbelievably 35 years ago. For those who knew him, his vivid, funny, profane presence, as well as his awesome musical talent, burn undimmed. And now he looks across two works of art across Dublin streets, one north, one south, at a city he would be unlikely to recognise. Vera Clute's massive head is in Sheriff Street, near where Luke was born. John Coll's graceful full-figure bronze is close to the entrance of Stephen's Green, not very far from where Phil Lynott, himself a devoted Dubliners fan, has held court for years. Ireland and Dublin have changed almost beyond belief since Luke and the Dubliners held sway in O'Donoghue's pub on Merrion Row, promoted initially by the laconic and still happily very much with us Noel Pearson. Dublin, despite their mischievous presence, was still a fairly prudish and closed society in 1984, the year Luke died. Official Ireland was still suspicious of outside cultural influences, along the lines of the then quite recent claim by the Laoise Offaly TD and father of our current Minister for Justice, Oliver J. Flanagan, in the Dáil, that there was no sex in Ireland before RTE. Many frowned censoriously at the worldwide fame achieved by Luke, John, Ronnie, Barney and Ciarán. Happy to laud their music, maybe, but some people lamented their freewheeling ways. The music might be a great advertisement for Irish culture and a visible boost to our tourist trade. But what about our reputation as an island of saints and scholars, they wondered. Did the Dubliners fit that? For the rest of us, the Dubliners were that. They were unpretentiously learned and, of course, gloriously talented in all aspects of folk music. But there was always joy in the Dubliners' music. It was never self-conscious, never overtly political, never defensive, just real, warm and soaringly musical. Mean-minded condemnation of lack of national purity never bothered them. They weren't in the business of saving Ireland from itself. And they dropped traditional rebel songs from their repertoire when the conflict in Northern Ireland escalated. Luke Kelly, Ronnie Drew, John Sheehan, still happily with us, Ciarán Burke and Barney McKenna were the original Dubliners. Ciarán, sadly, was the first to go. He had to leave the group, his health after a brain hemorrhage, unable to stand the pace of touring. Jim McCann of the Cherubic Countenance and Impish Smile joined later, followed even later by Eamon Campbell and Paddy Riley. Ronnie came and went. And there were others as the years went on. The music played on. But the soul went out of things when Luke died. He was only 44, but he had lived as hard as he'd worked and had been diagnosed with a brain tumour in 1980. I'm proud to this day that he personally taught me my party piece. I have no illusions about my talents. I'm an audience, not a performer. But Luke apparently thought I could do a rendition of An Owl Man Came Courtin', also known as For He's Got No Falorum. There's an imp in that face of yours, he told me. I remember the day well, and looking back, the shadow of the illness that would take him might well have been hanging over him already. Walking in Grafton Street, I ran into Luke. "Are you coming to Grogan's for a pint?" he asked. "With Luke? Of course I was," even though it was only 4:30 in the afternoon. It was freezing cold, the atmosphere was dank, and Luke's cloud of fiery curls shone like a burnished halo. He was interestingly clad. The inside seam of a pair of green trousers was ripped from top to bottom, providing a flapping, one-sided skirt effect. Fair enough, if chilly on a November afternoon. But Luke wasn't wearing underclothes, to use the most polite term. Perched on a stool in Grogan's, he smiled pleasurably into a creamy pint, remembering only from time to time to sweep his trouser skirt across his family jewels, to use another polite term. And he did that only after I'd overcome my convent education enough to point my finger meaningfully in their direction. Then, mercifully, the subject was changed, and we got on to the repertoire. That was when he demanded I produce paper and pen so he could write out the verses of An Owl Man, underlining the emphasis he wanted, marking the pauses and circling the bits to be drawn out. "That'll do you now," he beamed, handing it to me. Sadly, the paper has not survived the years, although his notations are still in my head. "That was great crack," he said outside the pub, giving me a smacking kiss and disappearing into the damp darkness, his green train flowing regally behind him, as befitting a musical king.
From the balcony of my Calabrian home in the Tour of Italy, I would look across the Netto Valley to the neighbouring town of Strongoli. Few knew its ancient name, Petelia. Fewer still that it was to this hilltop stronghold that the slave army of the Thracian Spartacus rallied after a short-lived triumph in 71 BC. Having graduated from slave in North Africa to trainee gladiator in Capua, Spartacus went on to lead a rebellion against the might of Rome. This was not the first time I'd crossed paths with this iconic historical figure, for when I first saw the extraordinary landscape that is California's Death Valley, I knew it was here, amid the astonishing kaleidoscope of colours, hues and shapes, that the opening scene to the film Spartacus was shot. For a few weeks in 1959, Zabriskie Point in Death Valley became the Nubian quarry where, in a memorable opening scene, Kirk Douglas, as Spartacus, first staggered into view, struggling to keep upright under the weight of a wooden, rock-filled hod on his back. As an inquiring Belfast teenager, I first read hard, fast novel Spartacus in the late 1950s. It left an indelible impression on me, not only through the emotion of the story itself, but also because it inspired me to investigate what was known as McCarthyism. 5,000 miles away, in Los Angeles, producer and actor Kirk Douglas was also reading Spartacus and was keen to make it into a film. Hard Fast, a respected American writer, had begun writing Spartacus while serving a 3-month prison term for contempt of Congress following his interrogation by the House Committee on Un-American Activities, the invidious quasi-court overseen by Senator Joseph McCarthy. McCarthy was obsessed with the notion that the media, and Hollywood in particular, was churning out communist propaganda. Those who refused to out colleagues with left-wing or socialist views could be indicted for subversion or treason on little or no evidence. Like other authors, actors, and screenwriters, Fast was blacklisted, and nobody would touch his work. When 8 publishing houses rejected Spartacus, Fast was forced to go it alone and self-publish. At the same time, a prolific and respected screenwriter, Dalton Trumbo, also fell foul of McCarthyism and spent almost a year in prison. On his release, Trumbo too was blacklisted and, theoretically at least, unable to work. For fear of being blacklisted themselves, few in the movie business were prepared to openly challenge such practices until, that is, Kirk Douglas took a stand and almost single-handed began to dismantle the whole tawdry business. Having publicly recanted his views in the mid-50s, Howard Fast became less of a persona non grata, and Kirk Douglas bought the rights to Spartacus in 1957 within days of reading it. Fast was keen to write the script himself, but his first submission was later described by Douglas as awful. Lifeless characters uttering leaden speeches. It was as if he hadn't read his own novel. For Kirk Douglas, the battles raged off-screen as well as on. The cast, a galaxy of household names that included Laurence Olivier, Gene Simmons, Peter Ustinov, Charles Laughton, and Tony Curtis, was not easy to manage. In addition, Stanley Kubrick, brought in to replace Anthony Mann as director after just a week, was a law unto himself. And despite his contract not giving him full artistic control, all but usurped the role of cinematographer. Spartacus's new screenwriter, known to cast and crew as Sam Jackson, caused problems too. For nobody, except Douglas and a few close associates, knew he was none other than the blacklisted Dalton Trumbo. On leaving prison, Trumbo had continued writing screenplays and even won two Oscars under assumed names. When it came to these films' credits, Trumbo's name was nowhere to be seen. With his film nearing completion, and despite the many battles he had faced to get it this far, Kirk Douglas decided to stand up for what he believed. Perhaps, like Spartacus, he was in the mood for a rebellion. When Douglas openly named the blacklisted Dalton Trumbo as the screenwriter of Spartacus, there were deep intakes of breath. Some rallied to the cause or showed muted support for his stand, while others demonstrated vociferous opposition. The studio, Universal, which had already poured millions into the project, had no option but to go along with Douglas's stance. To do so was the only way they could recoup their investment. Through the resolve of one man, Kirk Douglas, the Hollywood blacklist was finally shattered. People ignored the mantra of the fearmongers that both author and screenwriter were commies and flocked in their millions to see Spartacus. Even JFK took time off from being president and sneaked into a Washington cinema with a bevy of bodyguards. What the audience and JFK didn't know was that Douglas had had to fight one final battle with director Stanley Kubrick. Douglas had an idea for the film's denouement, and, reluctantly, Kubrick finally agreed to shoot it. Ironically, for many, it was to become the film's most memorable moment. It is the aftermath of the final battle against Rome's legions. The slave rebellion is over. Spartacus's army, either dead or captured. The Roman general Crassus wants Spartacus and demands that the prisoners give him up or be crucified. One by one, in a poignant demonstration of selfless solidarity, each slave calls out, "I am Spartacus." There is, of course, only one Spartacus. He is 102, and his name is Kirk Douglas.
He thinks that birds exist purely for his entertainment and exercise. He loves Lyric FM when he's in the car, but isn't so gone on the Six Nations rugby commentary. He thinks that the shower going full blast in my ensuite is the funniest thing he has ever seen. He adores the feel of the sand under his feet on the beach, but he can't quite get his head around all that wet stuff called the sea. He's a native of Inland Meath, so he makes a run for it every time the waves get too close for comfort. He also likes nothing better than a bit of a snooze under the table inside Café Gourmet in Greystones, and he is utterly incapable of understanding at any time of the day when I'm around why he simply can't go everywhere, and I mean everywhere, with me, like into the aforementioned shower. Just last month, Dudley thundered into my life and changed it for the better. He's a 10-month-old wire-haired dachshund, very smart and completely adorable. When it comes to dogs, I've had a few, most notably Oscar and Finn, Irish Wheaton Terrier brothers who were utterly central to the lives of myself and my late husband Jerry for many, many years. Oscar died in 2011 when he was 12, while Finn made it to December 2014, just 1 month short of his 16th birthday. We were grief-stricken at the loss of our adored dogs, but then, just 6 months after Finn died, grief took on a whole other meaning for me when I lost my beloved husband. It's been a long, hard journey ever since, as I have attempted to drag myself, day in and day out, up to the surface and out of that black hole where grief continued to hold me prisoner. Oh, I have done my job to the best of my ability. I have had occasional nights out with close friends, and I have travelled, mostly alone, but sometimes in the company of my adult son or my sister, to different parts of the world. I have tried, in other words, to get on with the kind of life that has been left to me after such an overwhelming loss. But have I been happy? Have I known moments of unbridled joy? Have I actually spontaneously laughed out loud? Have I woken up even one morning in the last 3 years and 10 months without my husband being the first thought in my head? Without, in fact, speaking aloud to him before I even throw back the covers, plant my feet on the floor, and face into yet another day without him? The answer to all those questions is no, not until now. Just a few nights ago, in the quiet of my apartment, I suddenly heard a noise. What was it? I wondered for a moment. And then I realised that it was me, that I had laughed, really laughed, out loud. Why? Because Dudley had suddenly spotted his favourite soft toy, an old black and white panda, on the other side of the room, and had launched himself off the sofa with such joy and vigour that when he landed on the rug, it took off like a magic carpet, flying across the wooden floor with Dudley on board. And so comical was it that it made me laugh in a way that I haven't laughed in a very long time. Dogs are great medicine, and this adorable little dachshund has already given me a bit of my mojo back. Just to see his happy face and his waggling tail first thing every morning when I open the door to where he sleeps in the living room has done me more good than any of the grief counselling that I've had over the past few years. He needs me, and I need him. We are bound together. It's as simple as that. Dogs teach you so much about life, to appreciate the simple things, to love with all your heart, to always be yourself, to live in the moment. And their gift for loyalty is simply immeasurable, and not just for their human owners. When our terrier Oscar was just a few weeks from death back in 2011, his brother Finn became his carer. So we would come upon him, in the kitchen perhaps, or out in the garden, standing tight up against his frail brother, leaning into him, offering him comfort. And they'd stand there together for ages, the two of them, joined forever in blood and in love, with Finn gently licking Oscar's ears or snuffling his fur, as if to reinforce to his dying brother that he was there, that he wouldn't leave him, that he'd stand by him to the end, as he did. And now it's just me and Dudley. And as I step tentatively out of the shadows to embrace this more joyful life that is now beckoning me, I can only give thanks for the affectionate and ebullient little dog who has come into my life and is doing his very best to make me whole again. And I can't help but reflect on how extraordinary it is that this small, hairy dachshund has so quickly helped to finally ease my grief and let me laugh again.
This year, Edna O'Brien's Country Girls trilogy has not only been chosen by Dublin City Council Library as the 2019 Dublin One City One Book, but the Abbey Theatre is currently hosting a stage production of The Country Girls, adapted by the author herself. Maybe it was the fact that Edna originally wrote her Country Girls around the time my friend Mary and I were born. Or maybe it's because she was a pharmacist herself. But when I first befriended Mary from Sligo, a fellow first year as we arrived into Trinity College in the late 70s, I quickly christened the two of us the Country Girls. Both of us pharmacy students and both of us wearing brown coats. Mine, dark chocolate, purchased in bowls of Boyle, was an A-line gabardine with a tartan lining. Mary's, milk chocolate brown with a rainproof finish. Our mothers obviously shared a practical dress sense to keep their daughters warm and dry in this serviceable colour. College brought us together, as well as our student hostel, the daily number 11 bus, and the weekend train home west from Connolly Station, which everyone still called Amien Street Station. I spent those first months in Dublin in a state of homesickness. Food tasted strange as garlic passed my lips for the first time and Spanish omelettes were served up instead of the egg in a cup of home. Accents and faces were foreign and the bustle of city traffic was terrifying. Old friends from my co-ed school were scattered elsewhere and tackling the unfamiliar cobblestones of Trinity felt like stepping into Mallory Towers, far from my Roscommon landscape. Home had not prepared me for sharing bedrooms with sleepwalkers and snorers. First kisses and first heartbreaks I handled back home, but this sudden immersion into the city of Anna Livia was such a culture shock. On the other hand, Mary was far from homesick. A convent boarding school had taken care of that when she was 12. However, her innocence with the opposite sex was as chronic as my homesickness, so we had many midnight chats on the subject of boys, romance and passion. And though we were in some ways an unlikely pair, loneliness like an autumn scarf wove into our brown coats and drew us closer as we unbuttoned the differences in each other, delved into the lining of our lives. We discovered we both loved music. Mary enjoyed piano and I guitar. Sessions in the hostel distracted me from myself where John Denver and Billy Joel shared the playlist with Schubert and Beethoven. We also invented a unique duet on the hostel staircase using patella hammers and spent hours in huddles of girls, just talking. College boys from Wexford, Galway, and Sligo began to turn our heads and my experience in matchmaking helped when I got Mary invited to her first dinner dance in Wynn's Hotel. She in pink and I in lilac. Our saucer eyes still stand out as much as the crimpling in those now fading studio photographs stashed in a memory album. Slowly, I settled in, but longed daily to hop on the train armed with the plug of tobacco from Peterson's shop for Pat next door, or to tear off down the street at home on the high Nelly I'd borrow from his niece Valerie. Mary had other reasons to go home as her father's health faded, so our weekends became familiar with the train stops at Maynooth, Mullingar and Ballymote. Gradually, we learned to live in our new elsewhere. We shed the layers of the country girl with the Pav, the Cumberland and O'Neill's, our trendy spaces, as well as the charm of Grafton Street, as we discovered Captain America's, Switzer's and the luxurious Brown Thomas. Like Edna O'Brien's Kate and Baba, sleeve in sleeve we were seldom seen apart. Long conversations were sewn into our seams and so many secrets stashed under each other's collars. Edna's Country Girls, often referred to as the quintessential tale of Irish girlhood, to my mind is not the novel that broke the mould. It is the one that made it. And we too moulded ourselves out of girlhood, on topics censored for so long. We grew with the liberation we sensed among the student union meetings on Trinity's dining hall steps. Over the years, we travelled on bicycles, then in cars, from hostel to flat to house and then apart as life brought us away from Dublin and each other. But our friendship endured and through marriage, children and shared moments, we continue to stay close. Next weekend, we will both spend a night back in Wynn's Hotel. After all, it's a country girl's hotel, and that evening we'll attend the Abbey production of Country Girls. We'll toast Baba and Kate and raise a glass to our mothers who ensured we had an independence of spirit that Edna O'Brien gave to her heroines. We'll thank women like her, and above all, we'll celebrate in gratitude our three decades of friendship. And maybe, just maybe, we will arrive into Connolly Station, both wearing a brown coat.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Writings on the Wall by Conall Hamill, The Day Luke Kelly Came Courtin' by Emer O'Kelly, I Am Spartacus by Niall Allsop, and that was recorded at the recent Sunday Miscellany Live at the Ennis Book Club Festival. After that, we heard Dudley the Griefbuster by Rosalind Dee, and finally Country Girls by Noel Linsky. The music was Vici d'Arte from Puccini's Tosca, sung by Maria Callas with the Paris Conservatoire Orchestra, conducted by Georges Prêtre. Then we heard Maids, When You're Young, Never Wed an Old Man by the Dubliners. After that, we heard Adagio of Spartacus and Phrygia by Aram Khachaturian, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Khachaturian. And finally, Good Dog was composed and played by Bill Carruthers on piano.